Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So a couple of announcements. One is we now have two class ombuds, Ashley Moore and Dave Rosen. Ashley, stand up so everybody knows who you are. Wave your hand. That's Ashley. Dave, where's Dave?
Not here yet.
Okay, when Dave Rosen comes, everybody knows Dave. So the role of the ombuds is to help provide feedback to primarily Mary and I about the class. So if there are things that you don't feel comfortable for whatever reason coming to one of us about, you can anonymize yourself by going to Ashley or Dave and talking to them about it. And we will set up meetings with the two of them a couple of weeks into the class to gather that feedback. So, and they can come to us anytime. Also, if you did not get email saying you're on the email list for this class, then you aren't on the email list for this class, and we need to get you on it. So Mary's going to just pass these sheets around. If you already filled one out and you got email, both of those things, you don't need to put your name down again. But if you did not get email, please put your name on this sheet, because if there's a problem with a homework or something like that, we will use this email list to send things out. If you were pre-registered for the class, you should be on it. There's Dave Rosen coming in the back. Put you up here. If you were pre-registered or you signed the sheet before, you should have received actually probably two email lists, one messages, one saying you're subscribed and another one from me saying you're subscribed. I forgot to mention on Monday, one of the requirements for the class, which is you are required to attend office hours at least once in the first 3 weeks of class. You don't have to ask an intelligent question. You don't have to do anything but show up. But you need to go to office hours. The TAs will have a sign-up sheet and say, I showed up. All right, and we do that so that you know where the office hours are and you know what the TAs look like and you know that, in fact, they're just as nice as they appear in their picture. So that's a requirement for the class. There are a couple of things that we also need you to return. So reminder that the course surveys, and we handed those course surveys out. There are some more on the outside table. They were handed out on Monday. Please turn those in. They are what help us understand the background of the class. They're very important for us. We need them by today at 3 because the TAs are meeting, and they will look through those a little bit. So if you didn't get one, grab one off the table as you head out. Fill it out. It won't take you more than a couple of minutes to fill out, and please leave it in one of the mud card boxes or out on that table, and we'll pick it up. More stuff. I'm going to hand out a course scheduling sheet. This is so that we can schedule the recitation sections for the class at times that work. The recitation sections are for CDS 110 students, which should be this group. So please fill these out. They're due on Monday, so if your schedule isn't finalized yet, we don't need this back till Monday, but if you can just sketch it through and cross out the times that don't work, circle the ones that you like, then we can do that. And actually, Mary, can I hand these to you and have you just pass them out down the rows? Thanks. Okay. And last thing, if you did not get if you don't have a blank 3x5 card, then you should get one. And so what I'll do is I'm just going to start these around, pass them all the way to the back. If we run out, raise your hand and Mary will get you some more. Remember that we're using mud cards as a way of asking questions. If I go too fast or I don't cover something or I use a term that you've never heard before, please do that. So just hand these back. If you've got one, what a lot of students do is they just take one and tuck it into their notebook and keep it with them so they don't have to pick them up every time, but please take one. You never know when you're going to need it. Never, it's like, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide, right? Never come to my class without a mud cart. Okay, enough with announcement things. So what I want to do today is to really dive in a little bit more to some of the applications of control. And this is now CES 110, this lecture. And so I'll say a little bit more about what do we mean by control systems and engineering of control systems. I'll give you some example applications and talk not only about what has been done and what is sort of standard, but also where things are going and give you a little bit of a sense about where the field is going. I'll also discuss a little bit of course details for CDS 110, and because we have a relatively large number of first-year graduate students, I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the honor system. The reading for this lecture is the same as last lecture, which is out of the course text, chapter 1. Okay, so on Monday, We talked about this notion that a control system is a system that has sensing, computation, and actuation in a feedback loop around some process that you want to control. So, for example, if you have a vehicle and you want to do something like cruise control, then you have your vehicle, you have some sensing of the vehicle speed, computation, how do I decide whether I'm going too slow or too fast, and what do I do about it, and then actuation, the actual physical implementation of what you would like to do, go faster or slower. And we talked a little bit, and we'll talk more today, about the goals of stability, performance, and robustness. And I mean, the course is about this. There was a good mud card question about what's the difference between these, and so there's more detail up there. But the ideas of stability, performance, and robustness are what we'll cover through the class. So I'll try and clarify those things a little bit today, but also, of course, we'll be seeing them throughout the class. All right, so we sort of draw it at this level of block diagrams. I want to just say a little bit more about how are these actually implemented. And so up through about 1980 or so, and of course still true today, but very, very prevalent through the 1980s, what you would see in a control system is that there's the system, so that's the vehicle. You've got these sensors and actuators, and usually the sensors and actuators have dynamics to them as well. That is, that it's not a pure actuation. I apply a force and the car goes faster. I press a gas pedal. That's my actuator. That causes the more gas to go into the engine via some valve opening. The engine then starts to apply more power, and finally the car speeds up. And so there's some dynamics associated with that. They're the dynamics of the actual vehicle system itself. And then I've got a sensor. Maybe it's a speedometer, a GPS unit, some sort of inertial measurement unit, and it may have dynamics as well. And so I'll usually call this entire thing the process. That is the thing we are trying to control. You'll often hear it called the plant. This is the legacy of chemical engineers who worked at chemical process plants, and so they would talk about the plant. So if I slip and say we've got the plant, then I mean the process that we are trying to control, including the sensing and actuation systems. The controller, nowadays, is typically a computer. And so what happens is that we have some sensors. Those sensors are connected up to a computer. The sensors may be kicking out analog values, some voltage, for example, that represents what my current speed is. We then run that through an analog to digital converter, which takes that voltage and converts it to a number that your computer can read. And then someplace, there's a computer that does the actual control law computation. It's a digital computer, typically, and nowadays, always. And then I take that digital actuation command, convert it from digital to analog, so a D to A converter, and then I take that analog output typically and run it to the actuators. And so, for example, this might be another voltage that is applied to a motor someplace that causes a valve to open that controls, say, the amount of fuel going to the engine. And so we will very often talk about just the process and just the controller and ignore these details. There's often also in the computer a lot of operator input. So for example, if you have a cruise controller in your car, right, there's that little button or stick, right, that you move up and down, or set of buttons that you press in and out to tell it whether you want to set the speed, go faster, slower, cancel it, right? So there's usually some level of operator input. And so coming up through the 1980s, this is what in a control systems class you would study, and you'd look at all of these things. And for the most part, first term of this class will be about the types of things that go into this system. We will typically ignore, and I'll try and point them out at certain times, but for the most part, we'll ignore the implementation details of converting to analog and digital. We'll have some algorithm, usually described as a mathematical formula, that will implement our control law. I'll show you some of those today. And you saw some of them on Monday, and the computer will implement that that formula as a computer algorithm that runs. And in modern control systems, you do whatever that computation is over and over and over again, and so your computer is just looping and constantly reading the input values, doing the computation, writing the output values to the actuator. So that's the way, for example, a real cruise controller in your car works. If you go look now in cars, there are dozens of embedded microcontrollers, so microprocessors, that are doing these sorts of control loops. Every time you have just about any function where you press a switch or anything else, there's some computer that reads it, and often there's a feedback system around that to regulate the temperature in the car, or regulate the speed, or regulate the intensity of the dash if you've got lights that turn on and off. All of those things happen automatically. Okay, so an example, and really in some sense the main example of a controller is something that's called a PID controller. PID stands for proportional integral derivative control. And so we'll typically, and as we go through the class, we'll use this diagram a lot. We will typically have the process P sitting here. So this is the sensing, the actuation dynamics of the system we're controlling, and the sensing dynamics. It will have some output from the sensor that is compared to a reference value, R. So we say I want to go at 55 miles an hour. I'm going at 53 miles an hour. That generates an error signal, and that error goes into our controller. We then take that error, and we say I'm going too slow or too fast. I want to go faster, so push the gas pedal down. I want to go slower, back off on the gas pedal, and we send that into the dynamics of the process. And we will sometimes think about having disturbances. For example, if we have a hill or we have wind or friction or other things, we might think of those as external disturbances that come out. And in this class, and I'll talk a lot more about this next week, we will usually describe the dynamics of the process via differential equations. Here's a particularly simple differential equation, so a linear differential equation. These are usually vector differential equations, and this X represents the state of the system. I'll define these terms more carefully next week. We have some inputs U, some outputs Y. So we'll have some differential equations that describe the dynamics of the process. Now, PID control is a very old control technology that has three components to it. It has a component that looks at the present error, and for that we do a feedback that's proportional to whatever that error is. So here's a PID, sometimes called a three-term controller. The input that I'm going to apply to my process, so this is the process dynamics, this is the controller. The input to the process is going to be my current error times some proportional gain. I may also look at what happened in the past. And so I might have an integral error that integrates back from the beginning of time, whenever I started my controller, and that's right here. Now, why might I want to have an integral error? Well, suppose that I am going up a hill and I start to slow down. I was going 55, I start to slow down to 50, and I say, okay, well, I should apply the gas a little bit because I'm slowing down. All right? If I just had a proportional error, if the error ever went to zero, I would stop pushing the gas pedal down, right? Because K times zero is zero, and that's not really what you want. If you're going up a hill, right, you need to say, oh, I'm going up a hill, and so if I just push the gas pedal down a little bit, I'll get some error and I'll stay there, but I'll have a constant error, right? I mean, that error will balance out at whatever level it takes to balance the K times E with the amount of force to go up the hill, but I'll be slow, 3 miles an hour, right? And you'll look at your speedometer and you'll say, boy, this is not a very good car. But if I add an integral term, then if I have an error that persists, this term gets bigger and bigger and bigger if that error is positive, or more and more and more negative if that error is negative, and so this term will start to kick in. And so as a matter of fact, in your cruise controller, you have an integral error. As you start going up the hill, it might be a little bit slow. It will say, wait a minute, I've got a persistent error in the past. I'm going to add on a little bit more control so that I actually catch up and exactly balance that. Right. And so the integral term looks in the past and ensures that the error eventually goes to zero. Another way of thinking of it is that it automatically adjusts the set point of the input. That is, that the amount that I have to press the gas pedal to maintain a constant speed, that's sort of the set point of that input. Again, we'll define these more carefully as we go through, but that's the idea of integral error. And finally, I can also make use of anticipatory measurements. So I can say, as I come over the crest of a hill, I start to see that the speed starts to speed up a little bit, and I might anticipate that I'm going to start going down a hill, so maybe I should start to back off a little bit before my error gets large. I can wait till I go over the hill, and then I'll see the error start to grow, right? And as the error grows, I'll back off. But as I start to see that I'm just starting to speed up, I can anticipate that a little bit. And actually, anticipatory control came up in the context first of ship steering, as people started to make automatic things for steering ships. This is back in probably the early 1900s as you're steering ships along the ocean, and you start to turn and you want to anticipate that motion. So that's a derivative term. It's shown right here. And the idea is I look at the derivative of the error. And so you can sort of think of this as, if this is my error signal here, this curvy line, then I'm at some point in time. I have the present error, that's the current amount of error I have. I have the integral of the past error, and I have the derivative, which tells me which direction my error is heading. And so I look at a combination of error from the present, past, and future, PID. So that's an example of what is running in your car. It's what typically runs on thermostats, for example. If it's hotter outside and I need to constantly pump heat into a building, the integral turn, or cooler outside and I need to constantly pump heat into a building, the integral air will do that. Right? So this is an example of a controller that is by far the most used controller. We will get to this in about week 7 or 8 and sort of look at it in detail. If you walked away from CDS 110 with nothing else but the ability to design a good PID controller, then it's been successful for most of you, because that's really what a lot of control systems use. And so this is something you should absolutely plan on getting good at. And of course, as we do that, we have to go through these same issues. Stability. Do the solutions of the closed loop dynamics up here converge to the desired equilibrium point? Do I end up going at 55 miles an hour? Am I stable to that point? Performance. Can I track a reference? If I speed up, do I quickly speed up? Not do I eventually get there, but do I get there quickly? Those are different issues. Am I stable to that point? Eventually I get there. Do I do it in a high-performance way? I do it very quickly, for example. I don't overshoot too much. And finally, robustness, as we mentioned already, in the context of things like cruise control. Can I have my stability and performance properties hold when I have disturbances, this D coming in, or process uncertainties there? See, I use plant. Process uncertainties, where, for example, the weight of the car, or the friction, or the other things might change. So we also look at having it be robustly stable or have robust performance. So those are the sorts of things that in a traditional control design you do. This is the bread and butter of control engineering. 90% of control engineering is about this. Now, I sort of have put this date of 1980 and sort of said, you know, that's what things look like in 1980. As we move forward, the world's changing, just like it's changing in many other areas, and it's changing because computation is becoming cheap and ubiquitous, inexpensive and ubiquitous. So this is what a modern control system looks like. This is, in fact, the control architecture that we used for our DARPA Grand Challenge vehicle. And there is, and I pulled this straight out of the technical paper that we used, that is the process, the vehicle. That's Alice. So that entire complicated vehicle right there fits inside that little box. This path follower is, in fact, two PID controllers. That's actually what's running there. And we have a sensing system and an actuation system. So I guess I should say that is the process. So that's Alice. The process is these three things here. And that's my sensing system. My controller. All of the rest of this stuff is also part of a feedback controller, but at a higher level. And so the low-level path follower is given a path in space, drive on this curve down the desert, and it then tries to follow it. That's sometimes called the inner loop in vehicle systems or in process control. You'll often talk about having an inner loop and an outer loop. This is the inner loop, but you see there's lots of other feedback, right? You see all of these feedback paths, and so there are also outer loops. And in the case of something like Alice, we look at the terrain around us. We construct, so from environmental sensors, we look at the environment, we sense the terrain around us, we construct an elevation map. That elevation map says here's how high everything is around you. We use that to compute a cost map or a speed map. Here's how fast you can drive over those different types of terrain. And we then put that into an optimization-based planner that plans out the best trajectory for us to follow. So this loop here is typically called the outer loop of a controller. That is, there are sort of multiple pieces, but this kind of going around and planning out this path, or the guidance loop if you're in aerospace, for example. In CDS 110A, we will focus on the type of controller that goes in here. In CDS 110B, we'll talk about the types of path planners and optimization-based control that goes here, as well as the types of estimators, both sensor fusion for combining multiple sensors, but also state estimation that's sort of here and I haven't talked a lot about, that allows us to estimate from a limited number of measurements a complete description of the system. So CDS 110A, we're going to mainly focus here. CDS 110B, we're going to broaden it out to the rest of this picture. And nowadays, and it's the way we're starting to teach this class, certainly here at Caltech, when you start talking about a controller, it's really this more complicated system that you begin to look at. And again, because you can put lots of computation in, we're starting to do this. So in 110A, we'll cover the traditional types of control and the mathematical tools we need to understand more complicated systems. And then in 110B, we'll get into some of the more complicated types of control and the more modern types of control over the last 20 years or so. Okay, I want to also just say a little bit about active control methodologies, because you'll see this especially if you go out and either interact with control systems engineers or become one. And there are kind of two classes of approaches that people use when they do control system design. One is what I'll call black box methods. And the idea here is that I've got a process that I want to control. I ignore the details of what's in it. I look at the inputs, I look at the outputs, and I try to figure out how to get it to work. And so, for example, I might learn by observation, I might learn by training. There are various things, for example, if you've heard of adaptive neural networks or fuzzy logic, these are typically what are called black box methods. They don't rely on a detailed description of what's going on in the process, just the inputs and the outputs. There are a lot of advantages for that. I don't have to go and do a lot of mathematics and modeling and other things. It works very well when you have humans that are normally doing the control and you want to replace them with something automated. Then these types of techniques work very well. But there's some disadvantages, and these are disadvantages for certain types of applications. One is that there are no formal tools in these types of setups, or not as many, for investigating robustness and performance. What does that mean? That means that if I'm the flight control engineer for the Boeing 787, aircraft, right, and I'm the person who has to make sure that that auto land system really lands you on the runway, and I've done it via a fuzzy logic method, and my management comes to me and says, great, can you sign on this line and guarantee to us, right, that in weather conditions up to these amounts of gusts and runways across the entire world, etc., you're going to land within 1 meter of the center of the runway, right? I'll say, boy, I sure hope so, but I don't really have any tools to do that, right? And so maybe I sign, maybe I don't, but I don't have as many formal tools. In that particular instance where there's a high degree of safety associated with that, I think we would all prefer that there's a little bit more analysis that goes into it. That's what engineers do. And so these techniques are typically not used, for example, in the aerospace industry where you care about that. Or if you're going to put a lander on Mars, right, you want to make sure you really think it's going to work. But it does work very well in a lot of situations where you don't have that high kind of safety critical factor. And so in particular, as you start to get again to things where there's a lot more decision making and judgment that you kind of think of a human doing, these techniques can be very valuable. The alternative to that, and of course there are mixtures in the middle, but the alternative is model-based methods where we have a very detailed description of what's going on inside the system, and we'll usually use either partial differential equations, ordinary differential equations, difference equations, finite state machines, lots of formal modeling tools to analyze and design what's going on, and there are lots of examples of the tools that we have available here. These techniques tend to work well when you have complicated systems that humans can't control very well, and they're rigorous tools for investigating the robustness and performance, but those tools don't apply universally. They only apply to a limited class of systems, and in particular, they work very well for what we'll define as linear time invariant systems. They tend not to work so well for systems that are stochastic, non-deterministic, non-linear, like lots of nons. The big disadvantage of them is that you can't really use the tools until you have a control-oriented physical model, and sometimes those are hard. So, for example, people working in areas like biology and synthetic biology where you're trying to build metabolic pathways and other things, as Aliza will tell you because she's struggling with this right now, there are not very good models available to apply the control tools that we have, right? And so we don't know what to do there. So it doesn't always work. So these are kind of two approaches. You'll see different camps. It's sort of religion, right? You know, sort of go to some schools and they'll say, you know, boy, you should never bother with all of this junk over here because you waste your time. Just go in, look at the inputs and the outputs, put a fuzzy logic controller around it. It'll adaptively figure out everything. It'll do a great job. Sometimes that's right. Sometimes it's not. Depends on the application. So as you might imagine, in this class, from my introduction last time, and some of the things that we're going to study, we're going to focus primarily in this class on model-based methods, but there are other methods there, and it really does depend on what you're trying to do. Okay, so I've given a couple of these examples of control already. We talked a little bit about this Watt governor, actually a centrifugal governor that Watt popularized for steam engines. It's very interesting. If you go back, kind of the birth of automatic control as a discipline goes back to about the 1950s. So I have in my office an entire Scientific American issue from 1952. This is the picture from it, from the cover, that is on automatic control. So great quotes in it. One is that control of all things that are self-regulating or capable of self-regulation. That was how they defined defined control, so what the issue was about. And they properly identified that the main principle of control was feedback. I would tell you the main principle is feedback as a mechanism for getting robustness in presence of uncertainty, and feedback as a mechanism for designing dynamics, but certainly feedback is the key thing. And I love this one, right? Control will liberate man from the routine tasks of mere survival, right? So that's what this class is about, is liberating us all from the routine tasks of mere survival. I love teaching this class. All right, so not too long after that, a couple of particularly well-known examples come out. If you ask a controls person, you know, what's a control, what's a controller, what's a control system, they will often tell you the two simplest ones because everybody's kind of seen them. One is a thermostat. This is a Honeywell thermostat that came out in the 1950s. You still see it in old buildings, even around Caltech. And this was a very simple controller. It was actually a mechanical system inside, not electronic. This is the first cruise controller that was introduced in a commercial vehicle. This was in a Chrysler Imperial. This cruise controller is neat because if you look at it right there, there's a flyball governor. So they actually used a flyball governor as their mechanism for controlling the speed of the car. It was connected somehow to the driving shaft, right? So they, you know, taking steam engine technology and putting it on your new Chrysler Imperial. And so they didn't tell you about that part, but that was what was actually in it. Control took off as a discipline in a lot of the more advanced things as aircraft came into being. An example of that is an F-18 aircraft, and I picked the F-18 because it was one of the early what they call fly-by-wire aircraft, which means that it was no longer an electromechanical system that was controlling the flaps and the engine and everything else, but a digital control system. And so they actually converted all of the signals, just like the 1980s picture that I showed you. They converted the signals from sensors into those sensor voltages into digital signals, did digital processing with a computer, and then spit those back out. One of the big concerns, especially early on still, about putting computers is that sometimes computers crash. And so, in fact, in an F-16 and a lot of modern aircraft, they use redundant systems. So, in fact, the F-18 has a quad redundant, that is four computers that are all doing the same computation, and if any one of them fails, the other three can vote out the one that failed. Right? And that's the way they make sure that if you get, you know, the blue screen of death on one of your computers, right, you don't get the red screen of death on CNN, right, from everybody crashing to the ground. All right? So, there's a lot thinking about safety and other things going into these. Okay, so that's sort of where control started. I want to just say a little bit about where control is going. And, you know, if what you're going to do is you're taking this class and, you know, you're going to interact with some controls people or maybe use it, you may not see some of these applications, but if you're going to be in advanced technology or doing research, these are the types of things that are coming, and these are some of the things that the field is very much gearing itself up to address. So, these are in different areas, and so I'll kind of go through about four different areas. The first one is transportation and aerospace. And if you go into the transportation and aerospace community and say, what are the big themes for control systems? This came out of a panel that I ran now about 4 years ago. Here are what the people in transportation and aerospace say are important. Autonomy, real-time global dynamic interconnectivity, otherwise known as internet and internet in the sky, right? Everything talking to everything, air traffic control networks where the planes can talk to each other, all of those types of things. Ultra-reliable systems, still important, and embedded software, so the plane still can't crash, the engines still have to run. Multidisciplinary teams, recognizing that when you design one of these complicated control systems, you have people from many different fields all coming together, and figuring out how to do modeling for control. And we're going to talk in this class about exactly models of this form, and in fact, what this community says is we need more than that, right? We need models that are accurate hybrid models, and I'll just say a little bit in a couple of weeks about what a hybrid model is that we can analyze. And there are a number of different technology areas where this applies, from air traffic control to ground vehicle control to vehicle automation, space vehicles, etc. As I've said a couple of times, a lot of this driven by the military. So this is a DARPA chart of what a modern military battlefield might look like. And this is the San Francisco Bay Area air traffic control system. And those are two of the types of applications where in the aerospace industry people are saying, how do we do, for example, automatic collision avoidance in the air when we want to allow people to have free flight. So transportation and aerospace is a big driver of control systems for a long time, and one of the primary application areas. Another one is information and networks. So feedback and control in the context of information and networks. And really thinking about how do we design control systems when we have heterogeneous networks that merge communications, computing, transportation, finance, utilities, manufacturing, health, consumer, and entertainment services, right? And so the power grid right now can talk to the stock market, right? And you can make those two systems interact. When that happens badly, you get Enron, right? That's really a feedback failure in some sense, not robust to greedy business people. But as we start to automate some of those trading systems and other things, right, you get real problems where you can get volatility in prices, right, that cause your electric bill to get very expensive or not very expensive, cause the power grid to do funny things. How do we start thinking about what got described by this particular group as a unified field theory that connects together control systems interacting with complicated communication systems like the internet and complicated computing systems of the sort that we have now. And there are lots of applications of this, from control of the internet, which is something that Stephen Lowe here at Caltech works on, to looking at power and transportation systems. So, for example, Manny Chandy and John Ledyard and I have a project on looking at the power grid, to financial and economic systems, people in economic department, quantum networks and computation, people like Hideo Mabuchi here at Caltech, biological regulatory networks. All of these things are examples of networked control systems, and that's kind of a term that's coming up. And there are sort of two things that people worry about in network control systems. Control of the network itself, how do you send packets across the internet, and how do you make sure that they get to the right place at the right time, and control over the network. Given that we have these networks that connect everything, how do we have systems interact in a feedback way and be stable, highly performing, all of those good things. And so this is, I can never remember, this is either the internet or the air traffic control network over the U.S., where the air traffic control network is now thought of as an information system, right? Who's going to fly where, when? How do we make sure that when there's bad weather in Chicago, we all don't get stuck sitting in Los Angeles? And this is the Southern California power grid. So control is getting used in those areas as well. Robotics and intelligent machines, going back to, in fact, slightly before, and he was one of the drivers, this Scientific American article. In 1948, Wiener coined this term called cybernetics, and the goal in cybernetics was to implement systems capable of exhibiting highly flexible or intelligent responses to changing circumstances. That was the way that Wiener defined cybernetics, and in fact, we're still trying to do that, right? This is the challenge of robotics and AI and many other things. Just as one example of that, if you look at the way that the DARPA Grand Challenge was articulated in 2003, it was essentially exactly this, right? Can we design, can we implement systems capable of exhibiting? Right? So all of these types of RoboCup soccer and Mars rovers and, you know, little entertainment robots, the DARPA Grand Challenge are examples of what people are trying to do in pushing this forward. The big change there is, again, the amount of computation that we can put into something the size of this little IBO so that we can really start to do much more sophisticated things than we've done. So there's another area. Fourth area, biology and medicine. Many of you have heard about, hopefully, read in the papers, this, or read in Science and Nature, this idea of systems biology, that we're starting to understand the body, if you will, as an entire system, that we've now started to characterize the molecular mechanisms for what's going on in things like cancer and various other diseases, but also healthy operation. But what we don't understand is how all of these components are connected together and how we get robust behavior out of these very uncertain components. So I mentioned in the lecture on Monday that one of the things that feedback does is, for example, take transistors that have 10x differences in gain or 5x differences in gain and produce very repeatable systems. We all have tremendous differences in the details of the sizes of our cells and other things, and yet we all walk, most of us, right, in the same way, and we all have the same type of biological functions, and it's amazingly robust. And so how do we do that? And so how do we start moving from thinking about organisms as genes to organisms as networks of these integrated systems? And so again, you see this integration of many different disciplines coming together. Biological systems are particularly interesting because, unlike the control systems that we describe in this class, where we sort of think of having a control law and sensing and actuation and kind of simple communication between those elements, in a biological system, those are all mushed together in the way that some set of proteins interact. So those same proteins are used to sense and communicate and actuate and compute all at once. And so how do we think about those systems? Enormous challenge, and one that people in the biology community, people in the controls community are starting to do. These two examples here are chemotaxis. So people who come see me talk about future directions and control, I'll often talk about, in fact, going to National Science Foundation tomorrow to talk about, can we redesign the feedback control system of a bacterium? Right? Do we know how to do that? Right? We know what the pieces are. Can we make it do something different? Can we make it go to the location of a disease and release the drug that is going to help you just at that location rather than infusing your body with it and having all the side effects that come from that, for example? 30 years out? 20 years out? 100 years out? Don't know, right? But that's the type of thing people are thinking about, as well as looking at different types of biochemical networks and other things. This is some work out of Eric Winfrey's lab here at Caltech. Okay, and the last area to just say a little bit about is materials and processing. So when you look at something like an Intel Pentium, this chip, in order to get built, has an enormous amount of ideas and technology coming from the area of systems and control. And in particular, when you go and you sort of put together the reactor in which you're going to grow the materials that do this. So this is a reactor that was built here at Caltech, and this is from the PhD work of one of my former students, Martha Gallivan, who's now at Georgia Tech. You have to start looking at what are the conditions in which the process plant now evolves, and how do I look at the growth of the details of these materials, and as I get from smaller scales to smaller scales, this is actually an atomistic simulation that Martha did, looking at the growth of islands in a step flow, which is one of the types of ways that you grow materials. And the question that she was asking was, at the nanoscale, right, these really are molecules and atoms, how do I control that process? What if I want to change the number of steps, or I want to change the step growth rate, and I want to affect the properties of that system so they get a better material so they can have a faster Intel chip that does it. This was actually for superconducting materials in this particular case, and the quality of the crystal structure affects how good the superconductor is. So in all of these areas, some of the ideas that we'll talk about in this class come up. And again, in CDS 101, we'll kind of touch on some of the principles of control, but not dive into as many of the details. In CDS 110, we'll dive more into the details of these primarily scientific and engineering applications and the mathematics behind that. Okay, so let me just say a little bit about the sequence of CDS 110 beyond just this class. So, and I'm not going to say more about CDS 101 because I talked about that, but as I've already said, CDS 110A is really about a more analytical understanding of the key concepts in control. And so we'll do a detailed description of classical control and state space concepts. We'll actually do them in opposite order. We'll do state space first and then classical control. And you should think of this class as providing you with the knowledge you need to work with control engineers in a team setting. So out of this class, you're not likely to learn, if you just take this class, how to design a control system that somebody would spend a lot of money on or bet their life on. That's just the first class. But you could sit in a team setting and ask the right questions, right? You could say, yeah, but you know, where's the uncertainty that that feedback is, you know, sort of dealing with, right? And understand what those key concepts are. So I think of this as something where if you're going to interact with control engineers, we will teach you the key concepts that you need to know and the mathematical tools that go behind those so that you can work with people who've had more training. If you want to get some of that more training and maybe become a control engineer, then you should take CDS 110B. CDS 110B then talks much more about detailed design tools for control systems. How really do we design these in a much more modern setting? So moving beyond, for example, PID and moving to some of these optimization-based techniques and estimation techniques and talking more about robust control and synthesis of control laws. A common complaint for which we are trying to figure out how to do this better, but it's tricky, in CDS 110 is it all feels a little bit unsystematic and unrigorous. We design these controllers, but you kind of come up with them and you have these rules and it's not, you know, sort of a calculate out what you want to do and then go do an analysis and make it do that. In 110B, it's much less of that. In 110B, we're finally at the point where we can present the mathematical tools that are required to systematically design a control law that does what you want it to do. We're going to try and put more of that in 110A, but we got to get the concepts across and can't do everything at once. After you've done this class, you're at the point where you could do a paper design of a control system for a design study or something else. But you're missing an important piece, which is there's always a gap, and this is true in any engineering discipline and in most disciplines in science, between sort of what we can study in a classroom setting and the tools and mathematics and the models we use and what it really takes to get these things to work. In the past, we've had a class called CDS 111, which addressed that. It was an implementation class. We went in and we implemented control systems. We've got gotten rid of that class in part to allow ourselves time to teach CSWM E75, which is a design-oriented class, but much broader than just controls. We design things like the DARPA Grand Challenge vehicle, which has controls as part of it, but it also has complicated algorithms and sensing systems and things that come from other branches of, or other parts of engineering besides just control systems. But nonetheless, if you're interested in the implementation of control systems, one way that you can get that is to take CSWM E75. And in that, if you go down the track of helping implement some of the feedback systems, you'll get that implementation experience. That works if you're an undergraduate. It doesn't work so well if you're a graduate student. It also, for some people, they may not want to wait that long or be able to. This is a pretty heavy unit class in the third term when we get to this. So there are some other alternatives. In particular, we are introducing in both CDS 110A and CDS 110B a project track, where, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second in the 110A case, but the idea is that you can take some of the time that you otherwise would have spent doing homework problems and spend that time doing homework problems that are implementation problems, right? That is, going and implementing something on a system. And so we'll do that in 110A in the area of motion control, which was essentially what 111 was, so we're pulling some of the materials kind of from 111 down. And then in CDS 110B, we'll do that in the area of optimization based control, both estimators and sensor fusion in particular, as well as path planning, which is really the topics of 110B. So if you are interested in designing a control system that I am going to use, right, like a plane or a car or something, please take CDS 110A or B project track, because you will learn those very important things that it takes to get these to work in the real world. All right. So out of 110A and B, you'll understand what's important and how to ask questions and how to do an initial design in 110B. But if you really want to get stuff to work, you need to do an implementation of a control system, and either 75 or these project classes or a combination are the ways that we do that within CDS 110, that sequence. Okay. And just one last thing on the kind of course side and how all of this lays out. If you take 110A and 110B, you are almost halfway to a CDS minor. So for both undergraduates and graduate students, the undergraduate minor requirements are here. The undergraduate requirements for a CDS minor are to take CDS 110A and B, either CDS 104 or CDS 140A, and to do a senior thesis in an area that makes use of tools from control and dynamical systems. Yeah. It was the other way. It used to be that you had to take 140, and now you can take 104. Yes. So, and it should be correct in the catalog finally this year. We got it propagated through. There is another track, by the way, but probably not for people in this class. You can take CDS 140AB and CDS 101. Right? That's the other way that you can satisfy the course requirements. And if you're interested in doing this, the senior thesis requirement, if you are in an option that has a senior thesis requirement, you can do just one senior thesis and just have in that senior thesis that it have a content from CDS. So you're studying biology and you want to use some of the tools, for example, from this class in your senior thesis, and you've taken 140A and B, you take CDS 104, a six-unit class, you got a CDS minor. And we have about 5 to 8 students a year do CDS minors. And if you're going on to graduate school and you're doing things in this area, of course, it lets you stick out a little bit more. You're already sticking out some because you're coming from Caltech, but just differentiate yourself a little bit. So if you're interested, I can tell you more about that. Okay. Before I go on to the course project, questions on CDS 110, A, B, kind of roll out? Yeah.
How do we sign up for the project version rather than just the normal?
Talk about that just next. So, good. So, I'll talk about how to sign up for the project version just now. Any other questions? Okay, so let me just say something about the project. Good question. So, as I said, the project is focused on control system implementation. So in class, we talk about analysis, simulation, etc. Here, we're going to focus on implementation on ALICE. And the reason to focus on a particular system is it requires some work on our part to make sure that you don't have to do everything to design the control system, but just the parts of it that go along with this class. So we don't want you having to put sensors and actuators and everything from scratch. That would take too long. And so this is a vehicle that is ready to do that. And we've used it now for a couple of years for CDS 110, and so we can do that. And I'll talk some about what the types of projects are. But if you are taking CSWEM E75, you can actually combine the project for this class with CSWEM E75 and use some of the things that you develop as part of your course project in our 2007 Urban Challenge competition, which will come up next year. If you don't know about 75 and you're interested in it, go to gc.caltech.edu and you'll find out everything you need to see. Grand Challenge, GC. Okay, so how do the projects work? How do you sign up for it? So how do they work? Instead of a midterm and a final, you will give an oral presentation and a written report on the project that you're doing. The midterm one is not very heavy duty. It's just sort of a, here's a write-up of what I've done so far, and a meeting in which you describe to the other students doing the project, here's kind of how far I've gotten. It's almost an internal check to sort of make sure things are going okay and you're getting started and you're heading in the right direction. At the time of the final, you will give a presentation to that same group, as well as turn in a written report of your control system design. And so, more or less, you will do the same things that you'll be doing on the homework, same exact techniques, etc., except instead of just, you know, taking a Simulink model or MATLAB model and implementing it there and doing the plots, you'll go implement it on Alice and get it to run there. And to try and allow a little bit more time for that, you won't have to take the midterm or the final. You can use that time that you would have spent studying for those to do the implementation. I will have some additional lectures on control system implementation out in weeks 3 through 5 for people who are doing this particular track, and we will arrange those so they don't take any more lecture time than you would have already been using. And you're welcome to come to those even if you aren't doing the actual project. So if you just sort of want to know about, you know, how do you really implement these things in detail, I'll cover those. The total time for implementation, I would guess 30 to 40 hours spread over 10 weeks. Now, we're going to try and buffer that, and this is, I'd say, a conservative estimate on the low end. We're going to try and buffer that, of course, by having you not have to take the midterm and final, and in the second half of the course, you will only have to do some of the problems on the problem sets, because effectively the other problems you'll be implementing, so you don't have to sort of do them for the homework set. You will do them as part of your project and present it at the end. But having said that, it is likely to take you at least a little bit more time if you do the implementation track than if you do the standard track. Not a lot more time, we hope, and we're trying to have it, but as with all projects, there are unexpected things that happen that sometimes end up taking more time, and our experience is it takes more time, you learn more, right? So, I mean, it's a trade. You get the same number of units in the class. We will this time have it structured so that you work in teams of 2 to 3 people to try and distribute that workload a little bit. In addition, some of the homework problems, you've already seen one of them, right, the cruise control problem, are kind of lined up with the project. So especially in the beginning of the class, all you have to do is do the normal homework sets and you're getting the introduction along with the rest of the class. Before I talk about the project possibilities, the way that we'll do this is that at about week 3, when I announce the control implementation lectures and you start coming to those, will be the time that you start deciding, right, to do things. You don't have to commit yourself to the project effectively until the midterm. I mean, there's no difference between doing the project and not doing the project up until midterm time except coming to these optional lectures, right? The homeworks and other things will be basically tied. At the point of the midterm, you need to decide, am I doing the project and therefore I'm going to not take the midterm and instead do a small report and present my progress so far on the project, or am I going to do the normal class? You are welcome but not encouraged to do both if you want. I'll give you the higher of the two grades if you want to both do the implementation and take the midterm and final, but I would not recommend it. And then at that point, as you start going through, then you're not doing all the homework problems, etc. And if something happens and, you know, you're halfway through the project and something, you know, you get sick or something happens that doesn't allow you to complete the project, then it's a small enough group who do the project that will work with you to find ways to have it all be fair and not, you know, count against you in terms of your grade and other things. So that's the way the project works. There are lots of possibilities for the project, and again, we'll talk more about this, that are lined up with the things that we need for CSWEM E75, but also make good examples of control systems. So, for example, lateral and speed control for Alice, controlling the position in the lane, as well as the speed. Lane following control, the difference here being that the sensor feedback is not going to be a GPS position of where I am, but actual noisy measurements of where the lane boundaries are coming from camera systems. We'll do that that part, the noisy measurement part will do, but you have to design the controller that stays in lane. And also pointing algorithms and pointing control for having cameras that are on motorized beds that can point in the directions that we need to be looking. So for example, when you come to an intersection, automatically aligning with the center of the road going in two directions, even if those aren't directly at right angles. Right? And so solving that control problem. Those are examples, and for people who are in that track, as we get to the implementation lectures, we'll talk more about that. Right? So that's the project for the class, or the project track. Questions on that? Yeah?
Are there other possibilities that we could do other than working on analysis?
Only if you can come to me with a faculty member or graduate student who has the hardware parts of what you need done. Right, so I'm willing to talk about doing that. The hard part about it is, what you can't do because you won't have time is, I've got this radio-controlled car that I want to connect up to a computer and get to work. You'll spend most of your term getting the sensors and actuators to talk to the computer. But if you're working in a lab, for example, and you've got a biological, any of those types of things, then I'm happy to talk to you about it and put something together. It's mainly just making sure the infrastructure's there. Other questions? Okay. All right, so I just want to spend a little bit of time, about 5 minutes or less, on one last very important topic, which is the honor system. As all of the undergraduates know, and all of the graduate students know as well, Caltech has an honor system, and it's a particularly nice honor system in many ways. It's very elegant. What it says is that no member of the Caltech community shall take unfair advantage of another member of the Caltech community. It's important for a lot of reasons. Of course, in a research environment, this is part of just the fairness of a research environment, giving people credit for what they do. It's really, I think, the standard that you would think of for ethical conduct in a research setting or in an academic setting. So there's nothing kind of surprising about it. It's the way in which scholars work together. And so, in particular, if you're doing research, this is what you do, right? You don't falsify your data. You don't steal other people's results, right? You give credit where credit is due. And you don't take unfair advantage of other members of your academic community. And at Caltech, that means of the Caltech community. But what it really means at Caltech is that it provides a sort of culture of academic trust that's very important. And it allows me as an instructor to do certain things that I think make it more effective for you to learn without worrying about those things getting exploited in some way. And so it's very important as a Caltech undergraduate, and what most Caltech undergraduates will tell you who are alums, is that this really was an important part of their education. And so for most undergraduates here, you've sort of instilled that, and for graduate students coming here from other schools, this really is important. Many of you probably came from, because many schools have an honor system, here, if you want, it's like honor system to the extreme, right? I mean, the level of things that we trust the honor system to protect us against are pretty amazing, I think. In particular, homework. Okay, so we've talked some about that. You're allowed to do full collaboration in this class. You need to write up your own results. Nobody's checking that, right? I'm not going around and proctoring and making sure that you haven't done it. Our expectation is that what you turn in reflects your understanding of the work and that you have done that. And again, I'll point out that part of that is that if you are doing MATLAB, if you're asked to turn in MATLAB code or you need to use MATLAB code to implement your solution, that should be your MATLAB code. You typed it in, all right? And the reason is that that's part of the understanding that we're trying to do is how to use MATLAB, not how to take someone else's MATLAB file and use it. And I bring that one up only because it wasn't clear in previous years, and so we had some issues with it, and I want to make sure it's crystal clear. A little bit more, and the piece to extreme is, you know, at midterms and finals, I'm going to give everybody here an exam. It's going to be stapled. I'm going to say, please bring this back in a week, and I want you to have spent no more than 3 hours on it, and here's the materials you're allowed to use, and here's the materials you're not allowed to use. You're allowed to use the course textbook. You're not allowed to use other books, right? All of these things. And I'm going to trust that you all do that. And that means that I can make an exam that's interesting, that I don't have to worry about the fact that, geez, maybe someplace out there on the internet somebody's answered that question, and so I've got to make some arcane version of it that doesn't make any sense anymore, so it doesn't matter. I don't have to do that, right? I can think about a question that is really the right one to understand what you're understanding. And I can do that same thing in the homeworks. And that's important. It also allows you, of course, to take the exam when you're comfortable taking the exam, whether that's 3 or 4 in the morning that some people seem to enjoy around here, or, you know, 6 a.m., a perfectly reasonable time after you've woken up. And so whatever turns you on. So we will have those types of exams in this class. And it is important. The other thing, and faculty here sometimes have a problem with this, but it's an interesting one, and it's another part of the extreme part of the Caltech honor system, is that if we think that some violation of the honor system might have occurred, I and the TAs don't get to do anything about it except report it back to, effectively, you, the students. That is, to the Board of Control or the Graduate Review Board, which are groups of undergraduates and graduate students that then investigate that, determine whether or not a violation occurred, nullify any advantage that occurred, and so come back to me and say, okay, on homework set number 4, problem number 3, this person took unfair advantage, so give them 0 points. Right? Whereas my inclination might be to say, you cheat in my class, you're out. Right? I don't get to do that. Okay? What happens is that the students decide how to nullify that advantage, and they do, because I've had things come back, just nullify. There's no punishment in that. And then, of course, they have to decide how to protect the community, and that is to make sure that it's not going to happen again. And so it's something that really changes the way I think about Caltech and the way I teach at Caltech and the way I interact with my students. Many of you already have keys to my lab and other things and know how to get into those, and I don't worry about it. Right? I was a graduate student at Berkeley. First thing I noticed at Berkeley, all of the lab equipment was bolted to the lab benches. Right? In all of the rooms. Because if it wasn't bolted to the lab benches, it walked away. Right? None of the equipment in my lab and in many of the instructional labs even here, right, are bolted down. We start having to worry about the public coming in, but we really do trust the students here to act in a way that's consistent with the honor system. So this is important to me. I hope it's important to you, and I hope that you will honor it as I try to honor it. Okay, so any questions on the honor system or its application in this class? Okay, so just as a summary, we've talked some today about the applications of control. I've given you lots of examples of these things and talked through some of the details about how we'll do things in the class and some of the project ideas and other things. And on Friday, we will have a MATLAB tutorial. And again, if you have not used MATLAB or you're rusty on MATLAB, please come. Elisa Franco, one of the TAs, will give the tutorial. And so we'll see you all on Friday.